All right. Thank you, Ms. Hino. So, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the third matter on our oral argument calendar today. I will ask the clerk to call the case, and then I'll have just a few remarks before we proceed with arguments. Go ahead, Mr. Marshall.
All right, now calling file number 820-0273, Dr. Jane Doe et al. Versus State of Minnesota et al. And Pro-Life Action Ministries et al.
So just a couple of quick remarks. We're in our new format based on public health concerns and various orders of the Chief Justice. And so everyone is appearing by WebEx today. With that, I just have a few remarks about the arguments that are a little bit different from the norm. So first of all, I just want to make sure that everyone knows what to do in case they lose us by audio or visual. You have, I think, a form. And if you can just nod your head if you know what I'm talking about, you know how to make sure that we know if by some chance we are separated from each other. And then I also want to remind you that when you are not speaking, so in other words, when you're not the lawyer presenting and instead you are listening to the argument, if you would turn on your mute button, that will improve our sound quality as well as the quality of the recording, because we often, this recording will be posted on our website and we often use the recording in order to listen to the arguments later. And then the next thing I'll say is before you begin your remarks and your opening presentation, if you would identify yourself for the record as well as the client that you represent, and then you can proceed with your argument. Now, of course, we have the usual time constraints. Appellant has 15 minutes. The marshal has a timing device, and I'll just have him demonstrate that to you so that you know what to look for so you can watch your time. So it's basically a 15-minute countdown on a cell phone. And as we get to zero, then you know that your time has elapsed. Now for the split time that respondents are doing, it sounds like you already have an agreement to split it exactly. And so the timer will be adjusted accordingly. And then of course, we'll end with an optional 5-minute rebuttal for the appellant. So with that, I think everyone's straight on what to do. And we are ready to listen to your arguments. Counsel for appellant, you can begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Cardall, and I represent the appellants who are proposed interveners, Pro-Life Action Ministry and Association for Government Accountability. The Attorney General's Office's actions in this case claim discretion to prevent Minnesota courts from adjudicating the no private cause of action affirmative defense. I'm here to discuss, without interfering with the district court's four-factor test for intervention, that heightened scrutiny is now necessary in Minnesota courts statewide when these three factors exist. First, a lawsuit is filed against the government claiming violations of the Minnesota Constitution. Second, the government does not argue the affirmative defense of no private cause of action. Third, there's a proposed intervener present who claims that a court decision without subject matter jurisdiction will affect its interests as well as its efforts at the state legislature. The present status of the case below is a motion to dismiss was denied in most part. One claim was dismissed, but the rest of them are proceeding. These are constitutional challenges under the Minnesota Constitution of regulations affecting abortions or abortion facilities. The affirmative.
Carl, Mr. Carl, can I just clarify? So the motion. The motion by the Attorney General to dismiss has been ruled upon, including specifically the standing defenses?
That's correct. And the plaintiffs survived in virtually all respects. One claim was dismissed in the lower court. To further clarify, because of the there's a unique aspect of the lower court order on our motion to intervene. Pages 3-7, the merits of the lack of private cause of action defense were adjudicated. So the district court proceeding, is completed the defense that we're proposing in our proposed answer. So really, this is about whether we can intervene on and make our arguments on the merits on appeal. So this is the appellate court. And so the district court has already adjudicated the defense that we're interested in making. Of course, the Attorney General Office has made it clear it's not going to appeal that issue.
Mr. Cardle, can I follow up?
Counsel, go ahead, Judge Sleater, sorry.
Well, I just wanted to clarify that point. Is your, would you agree that based on the case law, and I think it was in particular the Snyder Drugstore case, that the court ought not to have considered the merits of the defense in purposes of Rule 24, and therefore, whether we agree with your position or not, we ought not to as well?
Well, that's right. And you know, that's not what my clients want, but that's how the court works. so we can't reach the merits because my client's not a party. We're a proposed party, and so we're kind of stuck with that. But I wanted to highlight that procedural posture because it's important to know what we're asking for. So we're asking for a reversal to allow us to intervene as a matter of right. But I think it's going to be necessary to vacate the decision on the merits so we have a fair chance to litigate the case below so that the court gets a full record on appeal on that issue. So right now, you know, we can't jump to the quick, but it does appear the plaintiff's going to prevail on many of the claims in district court. And so then what we would like to have is a chance to intervene below on this one defense, have the district court, and very well might decide against us, but on a complete record. When we were moving to intervene, you know, you kind of signal the arguments you're going to make, but you don't necessarily make them because it's not on the merits yet. And so that's why we would like to have a complete record if we're allowed to intervene. Anyway, so here's the deal with the three circumstances that I'm describing, which, you know, I've sent some supplemental authorities. There's a collateral case. What we're seeking is guidance from the Court of Appeals. We need guidance. My clients are willing to, you know, tomorrow sue the government if there's a private cause of action to sue government for a violation of the Minnesota Constitution. They probably file converse claims to the claims brought in this lawsuit. But we decided to intervene because that was the more orderly way to do it. And we thought it was the best way to present the issue to the court. The court needs guidance, I think.
Mr. Cardle,
yes?
You agree the guidance then, if in light of the answer to my first question, since we don't address the merits, we do have guidance with regard to Rule 24, of course, although not a plethora, but it's still guidance. My question to you as to the second factor, which generally seems like a critical fact, well, it's certainly here, the interest. And my question to you is, what particular case or cases would you point us to help define how we determine a interest? The reason I ask that is it looks like all of the parties seem to suggest that standing, which has a separate, is for a separate purpose, is the relevant interest. And yet I haven't seen that phrase in any of the cases, and the rule simply refers to claims and interest. And so what particular case would you point us to give us guidance in terms of considering that for your client?
Right. Well, I'm committed in a sense to the idea that that these requirements, you know, serve a greater purpose, and that's, you know, justice. And so with respect to interest, that is not as high, you know, requirement standing, but you're right. Interest is all that's required. And the cases that I pointed out in my brief that I thought were instructive were the Missouri-Kansas Pipeline Company versus United States U.S. Supreme Court case, basically saying that that a party's interests cannot be left to only public officials and the court's discretion. So my client's interests in Pro-Life Action Ministries, and they have a long history of advocacy in Minnesota and Association for Government Accountability as well, their interest is opposed to this litigation and the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court said in certain public law cases, we can't leave that interest to the public officials and court's discretion. And so I root my argument, and it's a public interest case. My clients have demonstrated over decades that their interest in the subject matter. They're even saying that if this is right, that you can sue the government for violating the Minnesota Constitution, we'll bring lawsuits. That's how much interest they have. And they're saying they want to intervene because it shouldn't be left to the Ramsey County District Court judge, the Attorney General's office, and the plaintiff to decide whether this affirmative defense applies. So
counsel, isn't that public interest argument that you're articulating here and that you articulated in your brief? Respondents argue you're making that for the first time on appeal, and then looking at the district court's order, it appears that your the interest you identified below was that your clients had interests as taxpayers. I don't see a discussion of the general public interest. So can you address that, whether the interests, what interests you raised below, and whether the public interest argument is properly before us now?
Yeah, there's a 83-page proposed answer to the complaint. And in those 83 pages, we express that we're opposed to what the plaintiffs want. And yes, we did argue taxpayer standing, and standing is evidence of an interest. It's recognized by the courts, and we're opposed to what they're doing. We also included the history of the organizations, that history is a part of the demonstration of interest, why they're opposed to the proposed outcomes in these cases by the plaintiff. So I think it's hardly waived, and I think it's far too strict. And in other situations, these are the similar presentations. Now, the reason why I limited the intervention was to save judicial resources and to emphasize that we've never done this before, where we have situations where a lawsuit is filed against the government claiming violation of the Minnesota Constitution. The government does not argue the affirmative defense of no private cause of action. And then there's a proposed intervener present who claims that a court decision without subject matter jurisdiction will affect its interests, as well as its efforts at the state legislature. So my clients are at the state legislature. There's litigation related to their victories at the state legislature in this court. They're well known to the court. I don't know why Association Government Accountability or the Pro-Life Action Ministry be treated any differently than the ACLU or some of the other groups in town with respect to, they have an interest. They're a decades-long player, and they're opposed to this litigation, and they have an interest in the outcome of the litigation, and we're using one defense.
Mr. Cardinal,
how is that general interest and interest relating to the property or transaction which is the subject of the action? Under the rule, it appears that you need more than just a general interest in the litigation. Otherwise, anyone that had an interest in the litigation could intervene as a matter of right.
As expressed in the history of the organization, Pro-Life Action Ministries, they have counselors outside the abortion clinics. And when these scared teenagers and young women approach them, they talk to them. And they talk to them about the regulations on abortion, the informed consent, the 24-hour waiting period. And over the decades, they've saved, I think, 3,500 documented babies. So for Pro-Life and Action Ministries, their interest is in making sure that young women get the information they need to make an informed choice. And so this is well known that Pro-Life Action Ministries does this. It's a part of our culture, part of our background. And so that's, I think, where there's an interest. There's interest there. Association for Government Accountability believes this is a big waste of money. They think that every time this defense has been raised, it's been successful. It's been successful in the Minnesota courts. It's been successful in the federal courts. And we don't understand why the courts would want to upset this arrangement where such important issues, 201 state legislators get together and discuss it collectively as almost like a family. And then we decide how this is going to work. And so
is it true, then, if I understand you correctly, that if Ms. Tabbert, when she has her time, tells us, we've decided we're going to interpose that defense? Am I understanding you correctly that your intervention would be over? You would no longer seek intervention. You would obviously you'd watch to see that they do it. But the point being is that would satisfy your clients if Ms. Tabbert indicated the Attorney General has changed his mind to do so.
Well, no, because the attorney, the lower court has already decided the affirmative defense.
But my question, but you've indicated already that the court was in error to address the merits of that. Would it matter whether it was your client that interposed the defense if we granted your relief, or the Attorney General says today that I've changed my mind, I'm going to do it? The point being, I thought you said early on it was would not be our purview at this point because it should not have been the district court's purview to address the merits of the defense, but your interest is the defense.
But today, now it'd be an appeal, right? Because the judge has already made up the judge's mind, so there would have to be an appeal. The Attorney General would have to appeal the decision to the Court of Appeals.
Well,
we passed the defense part.
I'm not following that completely. I understand your client appealed because of the denial of the intervention, and you said earlier that the court erred in addressing the merits of the defense. My question is, if Ms. Tabbert, and I, again, it may be a bit of a moot point, I'm suspecting, because perhaps you wouldn't be here, if she indicated the Attorney General wishes now to interpose that defense, the court would be required to listen to it.
Yes, Judge, if the Attorney General appealed that ruling, then the Court of Appeals gets to decide, and that's our point.
When you say appeal that ruling, that suggests to me that you believe that there's an appealable issue right now of the merits of the defense versus the denial of intervention, the Rule 24 decision.
No, what's before the court now is a denial of the motion to intervene. But lower court has adjudicated the affirmative defense and says it's meritless. So the Attorney General would have to appeal that to this Court of Appeals in order for us to be satisfied that this Court of Appeals is going to adjudicate the affirmative defense in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cardle. With that, I think the marshal will be ready to reset the clock. And which counsel for respondent is beginning first? If you just want to raise your hand and let us know. Okay, Ms. So I'm going to go on mute, Ms. Tabbert, and I think the marshal's got the clock set. We understand exactly half. Is that right? Is it seven? Okay.
Yes, very good.
So I'll go on mute, and Ms. Tabbert, you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Leah Tabbert, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the defendants in this matter. This appeal is from a narrow procedural decision, and appellants are trying to redirect the court's attention to something else entirely. But we shouldn't let them distract from what's actually the issue. The intervention by right requirements are clear, and they were clearly not met here. And for that reason, the court should affirm. Now, with my brief time, I'd like to highlight two issues that are outside of the proper scope of this appeal, and then discuss the two primary reasons why the court should affirm. First, in appellant's briefing, there was significant—
Can I just interrupt you a moment, Ms. Tabbert?
Sure.
Am I correct that if you were about to tell me, but you doesn't sound like you are, that the Attorney General wishes to interpose this defense, that we would essentially be done because the court would now have to consider that defense? Or do you believe, as Mr. Cardall, that somehow you would have to appeal the judges? Obviously, the judge did address the merits, but no one had interposed the defense. It was in relation only to the Rule 24 motion.
Yes, sir. I would say that since essentially the entire interest that appellants state here is the interest in having this defense adjudicated, were the Attorney General's office to bring the defense themselves, then they would cease to have any argument for intervention. I don't think that I can speak to the appellate structure of how that would work out. And I will say now that that is not currently something that the Attorney General's office is planning to do, although we are not inclined to go into the details of the merits of the defense on the basis of work product.
Can I inquire, however, it's a public record, of course, that that is a defense the Attorney General has raised many times. And my question is kind of a bigger question. Certainly, and all the parties note this in their brief, that anytime the word abortion is written down, it gets heightened, at least public interest. It would seem to me, and this is my question to you, if ever the Attorney General was to kind of have a yep, that's one of the defenses we pull out of the drawer when the Constitution is raised in a highly public, dare I say, highly polarized issue for which the Attorney General is representing all the polarization sides, why would not that be an automatic defense, and then we wouldn't be here today?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that, again, the state on basis of work product doctrine is not taking a position on the merits of the defense here, but each case requires analysis of the circumstances of the case and what defenses are appropriate. And I would
say... Can I just follow up? On its face, again, given the public nature and the different interests that the Attorney General represents, including the interveners in that sense, being the Attorney General, would it not be a reasonable expectation that there would be suspicion as to why such a common defense, which certainly would, if successful, end the case, is not raised when it's raised in so many other scenarios in which the Constitution is raised as an objection by a private party?
I'll agree with Your Honor that this is a polarized area, and that actually is part of the reason why the district court's opinion should be affirmed here. One of the two primary reasons that I was going to get to is the stengem presumption. The state should be presumed to adequately represent the interest of the public, especially in polarized areas, because otherwise there's always going to be someone who's upset. And if they have the right to barge into the lawsuit, then we're going to lose all ability to provide for the orderly resolution of disputes. So that's one of the two reasons that I would state that the district court should be affirmed here. The second reason is that appellant's interest is so attenuated and so generalized that, as Judge Cochran accurately stated, if they have a right to intervene here, then anyone would.
Now, but, counsel, what is the property or transaction that is the subject of the action within the meaning of Rule 24 in this case?
The subject of this action is the set of abortion regulations and statutes that the plaintiffs are stating or alleging are unconstitutional. So the appellant's interest in the efficiency of litigation strategy is not directly related to that subject, and their broader and novel theory of interest in the laws themselves is far too generalized, because anyone with a political opinion about the laws that the state has enacted would then be able to intervene in a lawsuit like this one.
Is this case similar to the League of Women Voters case in terms of the interest analysis, or is it distinguishable?
It's similar to the League of Women Voters to the extent that appellants are stating that because they have spent time and resources at the legislature advocating for these laws, that's exactly the argument that was rejected in League of Women Voters. Having advocated for or lobbied for a law does not give one a right to intervene in a lawsuit evaluating a claim that the law is unconstitutional.
Well, I think Mr. Kirtle was saying that at least some of the members of one of the organizations he represents do more than just advocate for laws. They counsel teens. Is that a sufficient interest? Or counsel teens and others, I'm sure, more than just teens. But.
Well, first I would say that seems to be a fairly new argument here, but it's so indirectly related to the actual subject matter of the lawsuit. The state continues to assert and believe that the plaintiffs lack standing here. And in addition to the plaintiffs lacking standing, the arguments that appellants put forth that pro-life action ministries have standing are far too attenuated to give rise to a right to intervene.
Is it true, Ms. Tabbert, as Mr. Carl indicated, if I understand, the judge, however, denied the standing argument that your client made, and I assume the Attorney General made the same argument with regard to at least, and in fact, I think I recall this in the motion, especially as to the church plaintiff and perhaps the other organization other than the doctors?
Yes, the district court did deny that aspect of our motion to dismiss, but I would counsel the court not to let post hoc considerations get into the evaluation here, and further, to acknowledge that any time in our adversarial system where there's a motion, there's always going to be a winner and loser, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't zealous representation on both sides, and the district court repeatedly found that there was zealous representation on both sides of this lawsuit, at least so far. With that, I'll just ask the court to please ignore appellant's distractions here. You can issue a straightforward and uncomplicated opinion affirming based on the requirements of intervention by right. Thank you.
Okay, I think in a few moments, Marshall will have the clock ready, and Ms. Braverman, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Jess Braverman. I'm the legal director of Gender Justice, and I represent the plaintiffs slash respondents, Dr. Doe, Mary Moe, Our Justice, and the First Unitarian Society in the underlying litigation. Rule 2401 has four distinct requirements, and as the court correctly pointed out, the Minnesota Supreme Court under Snyder's Drugstore did say that at the intervention stage, the court's not to decide the merits. I think the court was trying to figure out what role the merits had in the four prongs. I disagree that it even plays a role there. I'll start with one requirement, interest in the property or transaction that is the subject of the litigation. The subject of the litigation are the abortion restrictions that we're challenging. We brought a case seeking declaratory and injunctive relief, arguing that these restrictions violate the Constitution. At the district court level, Pro-Life Action Ministries and the Association for Government Accountability, the latter having no interest in abortion that they've articulated, just asserted taxpayer standing as the basis for their interest. That's wrong on two levels. I don't know that there's any clear guidance from the Minnesota Supreme Court as to the role standing plays in a Rule 24.01 determination, but I know it doesn't usurp Rule 24.01. In Snyder's, the court seemed to start with the question of standing, and in League of Women Voters, I don't recall them addressing it directly. But I will say, you know, they don't meet the requirements for taxpayer standing. That requires an unlawful disbursement of public funds. You know, I don't think the court wants to go into the business of telling the Attorney General it's unlawful for them to be making certain discretionary determinations in the course of litigation.
Can I inquire on that point then? Yep. If we have, that was the question I asked Mr. Cardle too, is what direction we get from these decisions as to defining interest other than the rule itself. So if you agree that there is no guidance, would you agree that it can be or arguably is something other than the same definition we do have with regard to standing, which is a whole different body of law and for a different purpose?
I do think that to the extent standing is a requirement rather than usurping Rule 24.01, it's required in addition to Rule 24.01. And the federal case law, I mean, there's federal cases that say the requirements for intervention are even greater than those for standing. But there's 24.01 is statutory. There's nothing in there that suggests in the plain language of that statute or standing. So to the extent that standing would apply, it would be in addition to meeting the requirements of Rule 24.01. A taxpayer intervention would make sense in a case where the subject matter of the litigation is a disbursement of public funds. Right, because then the taxpayer saying I'm the right person to be challenging the what I say is an unlawful disbursement of public funds, and the two in that scenario meld together because Rule 24.01 requires you to have an interest in the property or transaction that is the subject matter of the lawsuit, and in that scenario the subject matter of the lawsuit would be the disbursement of public funds. That's just not at issue in this case. So I don't
see. Ms. Braverman, your clients did win on the issue of standing. And if we assume that standing perhaps has a heightened requirement, because that oftentimes means a lawsuit or not, whereas intervention, you already have a lawsuit. And at least two of your three clients, I'm separating right now, perhaps the doctor and the certified midwife plaintiffs. I saw a reference to counseling and interest, even lobbying with regard to the other two plaintiffs who the court has said has standing. My question is, in a case such as this, how, at least as to the pro-life organization, I think I understand your argument with regard to accountability and government organization. Why is it that how much less standing would the interveners have than those two clients that you represent?
I mean, the first thing to consider is that this lawsuit doesn't challenge any laws restricting anyone's ability to protest at an abortion clinic. So that's not at issue in this case in any event. But I think the League of Women Voters case is very instructive on this. And in the League of Women Voters case, the Minnesota Supreme Court cites, among other cases, two federal intervention cases, Heath v. Daly and Northland. And in both those cases, anti-abortion groups sought to intervene in an abortion-related lawsuit. And essentially, and what League of Women Voters decided about the Minnesota nonprofit that tried to intervene there was simply having an ideological interest and lobbying in favor of certain laws is just not sufficient. And so League of Women Voters, I think, is directly on point and instructive, though this is a claim they're raising for the first time on appeal anyway. But our clients are arguing that they're regulated, that they and their members are regulated by the laws in question, and they are directly affected and harmed by the laws in question, which is not an argument that Plam and, I call them that for short. I don't know if they have a short word, but Plam and Aga have put forward in any of their briefs. And to the extent that Mr. Cardall raises for the first time the issue of being able to do sidewalk counseling or whatever it may be, there's no statute prohibiting sidewalk counseling in front of an abortion clinic that's at issue in this case. So even that, I mean, these aren't statutes that right, that they're not claiming these statutes regulate their members. That's what the court called for in League of Women Voters. So I would look to that case for direct on point guidance for this claim that they're raising on the first time on appeal. I also want to, oh yeah.
Does a potential intervener have to have a legally protectable interest to intervene as a matter of right under Rule 24?
It has to be direct, significant, and legally protectable, Your Honor. And that was in the federal case law that the Minnesota Supreme Court cited in League. So that's a quote from Keith v. Daly, which was cited in League of Women Voters. And they lack that. I would also call into question the idea that the Attorney General consistently raises this defense. I understand their office doesn't want to go into their, nor should they have to go into their work product and their litigation strategy. I will say that not only is it incorrect, Mr. Cardall has recognized in two occasions that they have not raised that defense in constitutional litigation. The first being Schroeder v. Simon, the case that he sought to join with our present case. In that case, it's a voting rights case where the Attorney General didn't raise the defense. It has to do with probationers being able to vote. The Attorney General didn't raise that defense, and he's aware of it. He sought to consolidate that case with this one on appeal. The second reason that I know that it's not correct is that if you look at all of the cases we cite for the proposition that you can challenge the constitutionality of a statute for declaratory and injunctive relief, and that's what we've done. And there is no case law suggesting to the contrary. We don't need to go into that here. That's the merits. But for that proposition, we cited Jarvis v. Levine, Skeen v. State, Doe v. Gomez, Cruz Guzman v. State, and a host of other cases, all of which Mr. Cardall acknowledged the state did not raise that defense because his issue was that, well, it wasn't adjudicated in those cases because it wasn't raised. So he's aware that it's not inconsistent for them to not raise that defense, and they don't raise it in cases where plaintiffs are challenging the constitutionality of a statute seeking solely declaratory and injunctive relief. It's not...
So Ms. Braverman, I'll just point out that your time has expired. You can complete your thought.
Okay. So I mean, the claim is not only incorrect, I don't know, you know, it seems somewhat disingenuous because if you look at the lower court arguments, Mr. Cardall expressly said it wasn't raised in those cases. Those are cases where the state was the defendant. The constitutionality of a statute was challenged for declaratory and injunctive relief, and the state didn't raise that defense. So it's actually not out of the ordinary. They don't do it in this scenario that you have in front of you, that you have in Schroeder, and that you have in other cases where no one's seeking anything other than this. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, counsel. So Mr. Cardall, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose. There you go. Go right ahead.
Yeah, my clients supported these laws at the state legislature. Important to point out, the people of Minnesota did too. And so the issue of no private cause of action affirmative defense being adjudicated by the Court of Appeals is a real one. I think this is a place where my clients, through me as officers of the court, are presenting an opportunity to do this in what I'll call a grown-up way. And that is there a private cause of action under the Minnesota Constitution to sue government entities, not only state agencies, but school districts, county officials, municipalities, watershed districts, drainage authorities? What I've told my clients in the past is, you got to wait till you get ticketed, and then you can raise the constitutional issues. And so this is a huge issue that the Court of Appeals should resolve in this case, not on this appeal, because this appeal is about the intervention. Now, if the Court of Appeals believes that there's a private cause of action to sue under the Minnesota Constitution, it's to say so, so that my clients can sue townships, municipalities, without getting ticketed.
Mr. Cardle,
so that's an important issue for the Court of Appeals to resolve.
Mr. Cardle, Ms. Braverman pointed out the League of Minnesota Cities, the Supreme Court decision. Do you agree that that decision would foreclose the interest that your client's claiming under Rule 24 in this case?
No. As I mentioned, that I mentioned the Exrop case in the briefs, that the technicalities don't trump the sound reason to allow intervention. And I can't imagine a more important intervention and a more important issue on the merits than adjudicating
is there
that.
I'm sorry, finish your thought, and then I have a question for you.
Right. So the factor that was emphasized, I think, two times by the Attorney General's office was, we're not going to take a position on the merits. Basically, we don't plan to appeal. So to Judge Cochran's questions, I mean, when are we going to decide this issue of whether Minnesotans have a right, private cause of action, to sue any government in any court for violating the Minnesota Constitution? I mean, I have due process clause claims all the time that come in, and I tell them, well, you got to wait till you get ticketed. You got to wait till you're sued by the government to invoke the Minnesota Constitution. Here, a plaintiff has gone into a district court and filed about 30 claims, I guess, it's identified by the Attorney General's office regarding abortion regulations. And they're saying the Ramsey County District Court has to decide, not the people and their 201 state legislators, who, by the way, have already decided. So this is about, you're saying, oh, the Ramsey County District Court is going to decide whether all the statutes are constitutional in Minnesota, and then you're going to narrow intervention so no one can participate? So we don't get to participate through our state legislature, and we don't get to participate in the court. And so the Ramsey County District Court, the liberal plaintiff organizations, and the Attorney General's office, who hasn't filed this affirmative defense, is going to decide. That's not fair, and it's not fair to Minnesota's women and these unborn babies either.
Counsel, as you know, the Court of Appeals is an error-correcting court. Can you point us to any case that Minnesota case that has adopted the sound reason standard that you're advocating we apply in determining the issue in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. The Exrup case says that we don't go on the technicalities. It's basically saying the same thing, that if there's a good reason to allow the intervention, the court allows it, so there's justice. And justice involves treating every plaintiff the same way. And so if the court's going to say, liberals, you can sue. Conservatives, you can't sue. That's a whole nother way to approach Minnesota's court system. Up till today, I've never seen anyone argue that there's a private cause of action under the Minnesota Constitution to sue any government entity. And that's this case. Now, Judge Slater might be right. It's abortion. It's different. But everyone's watching. And so if the intervention is denied here, it'll come up in another way. The reason I did it this way, because I thought it was an adult, grown-up way to present to the Court of Appeals, or a district court, now the Court of Appeals, a nice way to deal with this issue. But everyone has to play by the same rules. We can't have one set of rules for liberals who sue the government and want a set of rules for conservatives who sue the government. And so if this were a pro-life group that sued and the pro-choice groups were jumping in, would the intervention standards be different? And I'm afraid that they would be. And I want to reduce the bipolarization of the courts. I want to fight implicit bias in the courts. I want to fight bias. But when the court introduces bias, or the Attorney General's office introduces bias, that makes our job much more difficult.
So, Mr. Carl, I'll just point out that your time has expired for your rebuttal. It sounded to me like you had completed your remarks, but if you had a final comment for the court, we're ready to listen.
Thank you for your patience, Judge. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks to all counsel today. We very much appreciate the presentation that you provided to us. It gives us a great amount of insight into the issues in the case. And so with the conclusion of these arguments, the matter is now submitted to this court for a decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, this panel is now in recess for its conference. Thank you. Thank you.